From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Delighted to welcome to John Hannam Meets, first time since 1991, I think. David Icke, nice to see you, David.
Thank you, John. We must meet more regularly, mustn't we?
Yes. European tour, you're on the eve almost of a European tour.
Yeah.
New book, Everything You Need to Know But Have Never Been Told. Life's exciting for you. When we first met, you were a top quality TV presenter, popular, handsome, still are actually, solid career, supreme professional. Not quite enough for you, because since 1991, you've changed a lot, haven't you? It's been exciting for you, really.
Yeah, I've changed a lot, thank goodness. Because if I'd have still been saying hello, good evening and welcome on the BBC, I think I'd have taken a pill by now. Because by the time I left the BBC, in fact, the BBC, to be fair, left me. I think they were under pressure because I was the national spokesman for the British Green Party at the time. And the Green Party was starting to do very well then. And I think they were under pressure politically to stop me having a profile on the BBC, because apparently, as it was in those days, Ian Rush scored a hat-trick and the economic system is destroying the world, were incompatible. So, but anyway, it did me a favour, because I was pushed before I jumped, really, because I'd had enough. I mean, I found it a very vacuous world. They used to say about the BBC, they get so confused, they stab each other in the chest, you know. And I was glad to leave, but, you know, things did change rather dramatically, ultimately in a very good way. I travel around the world all the time. I talk to large numbers of people in each place. You know, it's a dramatic about turn from, you know, what was happening before. So I'm in a good space and very happy with what is happening.
Over 20 books, numerous DVDs, lectured in 25 countries.
Well, I've actually been to nearly 60 now.
Have you?
Well, just over 60.
You've sold 140,000 books, at least, perhaps a few more now.
Oh, well, I've no idea how many books, because I don't keep count. I leave that to others, and, you know, things have changed from time to time in terms of who's been publishing them. So you have no way of knowing the real number. But, you know, I have a barometer, John, which is basically how many people stop you in the street. And it's getting just incredible now. You know, when I was filming in London last week, you know, people from every walk of life. There was a Muslim mother and her two daughters. There was a guy who seemed to be from Indian descent. Then there was a lady who drove a car from the other side of the road to where I was walking, and three or four cab drivers stopped their cabs and came running down the street. And, you know, when you're stopped in the street in Sydney and New York and Los Angeles and the Balkans, et cetera, you know that what you're doing is getting out there. Because, you see, as you see, I live in a little flat, which I love. I've lived here since 2001. I've got a little office you couldn't swing a cat in, where I write the books and I do the videos and do all the research. But it's only when you get out there that it really hits you how far this has gone now. And it's a testament of what happens if you persist when everyone's telling you what you're trying to do is impossible.
When we first met in 85, we talked about railways on the Isle of Wight.
Well, I still talk about railways. Look around the room, John.
Yes.
All these pictures of Isle of Wight steam railways.
There was no YouTube and no website in those days. So now you've got half a million YouTube subscribers, and God, it goes on, doesn't it?
Well, it's just incredible, isn't it? I mean, you know, we both come from a generation. I think it's a very important thing, from a generation that has a radar and a filter that can see how it used to be and how it is now and how extraordinarily quickly it has changed. You know, when I started out doing what I do now nearly 30 years ago, your means of publicity for events was getting people to hand out leaflets in the street. You know, now you post something on the internet and it can go to ultimately millions of people. So it's things have changed dramatically. Not all for the good, by the way. A lot of them not for the good. But it's been an incredible lifetime. Same kind of with you. The changes that have taken place. I was born in 1952 in Leicester on a big working class council estate. And when I look at what the world was like then to now, it is extraordinary. It's like it's just like another dimension, really.
Do you have an inside or outside toilet in the early days? I certainly had an outside toilet.
No, I was born in 1952, and we lived in a house in Lead Street in Leicester, which was just off Wharf Street. You get the picture.
Yes.
And that did have an outside toilet. Yeah, that one did. But there was a new council estate built in the 1950s for the, you know, people who had come back from the war. And we got at one of those. My brother still lives in the same house, funnily enough. I was up there a little while ago. And that did have an inside toilet. Because of the nature of where it was built and when it was built, it was on the edge of Leicester. And I used to love going out on my bike into the countryside and watching steam trains and stuff. That was my childhood, steam trains and football.
You were quite shy as a kid. You didn't like sort of meeting people, not a good talker, failed your 11 plus. You haven't done too bad, have you?
Well, funnily enough now, I mean, it's one of the things I talk at length about. And I've written about this in the new book in one part of it. I think the education system is a disgrace. I think it's a disgrace for many reasons. And, you know, I left school at 15 to play football. Well, you could leave at 15 then. Never took a major exam in my life. Failed the 11 plus, which is great, because if I'd have passed it, I'd have gone to a school which didn't play football, only rugby. And I've written over 20 books, and, you know, I've done talks for years and years that have gone on all day for 10 hours without a script, right?
Yeah. How'd you do that, by the way?
Well, because intelligence, and this is what I would say to every young person listening, intelligence is something you have or you can develop. It's not something you have to go to school to be taught. In fact, true intelligence is suppressed at school. Because questioning is suppressed, having your own opinion is suppressed. And funnily enough, one of the investors in this film that's about my life that's being made, Renegade, is a man who, I met him actually the other day in London, a man who also left school without any exams started off, you know, with basically nothing. And he's now living in Monte Carlo, worth £200 million. And he actually has produced a book about his life in which he says the same thing. You know, a university degree is basically worthless as a measure of intelligence. It's a measure of memory, a measure of taking down and accepting the official story of everything and repeating it on an exam paper. And some of the most intelligent people I've met were not very good at school. I mean, I'd sussed it quite early when I went to school. I mean, actually, funny enough, on my first day, I went to school on my first day to infant school. And at lunchtime, I thought, well, I don't like this. And I ran home and I said to my mother, I'm not going back. It's horrible. Let's go down the shops like we always do, you know. But instead, what do, John? Look at this summer we've had. And these kids have been sitting in school, having an authority figure giving them the curriculum. I mean, the teachers are in prison as well. They have to give the curriculum they're told to give or else. And while they could be out climbing trees and expressing themselves and using their imagination, they're sitting at a desk being told to consider what X means in algebra. I mean, what the hell is all that about? I don't care what X means, funnily enough. And I've never had to know what X means throughout my life. And I'll tell you a story. We're filming at my house where I was brought up in Leicester, where my brother lives, with his film crew a few months ago. And it's very little changed from when I grew up. All the houses are still the same. And there's an area, there's a green area just in front of some of the houses where I spent most of my childhood playing football. It kind of brings it home to you, you know, how time passes, because one of the goalposts was a newly planted sapling with a big piece of wood that it was kind of taped to keep it going. that was one of the goalposts, and now it's a big bloody tree. But I'm leading somewhere with this. And on the other side of the road was this spinny, we used to call it, which is just a load of trees going down between two roads. And when I went back, and it was a Saturday, no school, and the houses are still the same houses, they're still, family houses with children. And I stood there, I was there about two, three hours maybe. And in that period, there was one thing missing on that green and in that spinny, children, empty. When I was a kid, it was kids everywhere. They weren't playing football, they were playing hopscotch, they were climbing trees. And I saw one child while I was there, and it was a little boy who looked behind the curtain to see what was happening when we were filming on that piece of green I talked about. And this is, you know, I think it's real sad the way that children are isolated increasingly more than ever in boxes. And, you know, when you're isolated in boxes, the box can start to form around your head, around your mind. And I think it's very sad. I wouldn't change. If someone could say, well, you know, you can be 15 again now, no thank you.
I'm Fenella Fielding, and whenever I can, I listen to John Hannah Meets.
You were a footballer, you earned about 30 quid a week. I know you retired through injury, but do they get too much these days, do you think? Do they get, you know?
Oh, it's crazy madness.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you see, you look at the way the world's gone. I used to write an article once a week for a football website years ago called Football 365, I think it was called. And the theme of the article every week was football as a metaphor for life. And it is, sport in general, really. I mean, you know, you go through life, you go through emotional ups and downs and stuff. But, you know, in life, those emotional ups and downs, they can be days apart or weeks apart or months apart. In a football game, there can be minutes apart or seconds apart, but that's the difference. It's kind of it's a focused expression of life, and the way football has gone is the way the world's gone. You know, you now have something like 6, 7, 8 people who have the same wealth as the poorest half of the world's population, and you see in football this same kind of theme, this same structure. First of all, you've got 11 players on the pitch at any one point who are actually doing it. And then you've got tens of thousands watching them doing it, which is what tends to happen with the people that run the world. And you've got the players earning just breathtaking amounts of money. For frankly, you know, it's kind of entertaining if you like that sort of thing, but it's still guys kicking a bag of wind about and trying to get it into a bloody onion bag, a net, and they earn this phenomenal money while people are scripping and going without, lots of them, to actually buy the ticket at a time when football clubs get so much from television that the ticket price is really negligible to their income. They could bring it down, but they don't. Why? Because the owners of the clubs want to squeeze every last penny out of the fans. And that's what happens in life in general. You've got the few squeezing the last penny out of the population. And something else, of course, is happening in football. And that is, as is happening again with radio stations, with newspapers, with the media in general. And that is that billionaires, often from another country, another continent, with no kind of local connection at all, are just buying up these clubs as investments. And I remember football clubs when they were owned by local people, like a local businessman or something. And you know what I find so sad, talking just across the water from where it happened, that Portsmouth Football Club got into this terrible financial mess that almost took it out of existence. And then the fans eventually bought it and got control of it. And so, yeah, the fans own the club. Fantastic. What are the fans of those that own the club for the fans? What do they then do? They sell out to a Disney billionaire who then kicks them off the board so they have no say. And this is such a wonderful example of the way, you know, people give their power away to these rich, mega rich people, and even watch them on the football pitch. I mean, £300,000 a week for kicking a ball about. It's grotesque, actually. It's almost beyond description how ridiculous it is.
David, that Wogan in late 1991 sort of changed your life forever, really, didn't
right.
it? Looking back, it was a good move from your point of view, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't a good move in the sense that it was calculated, it just happened, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because most people, if you look at them, someone upstairs banging, putting the carpet in, are you? You know, I was just telling you, wasn't I? I love living here because it's so quiet. It always is. We started this radio interview, and for the first time in living memory, someone's banging upstairs. Anyway, most people live in a prison called fear of what other people think. People are becoming more and more pressured to do that. Political correctness and you can't have an opinion that someone else doesn't agree with. The pressure to not say what you think and not be you, but whatever someone says you must be. Pressure has never been greater, particularly on the young. And when you look at most people, they are in fear of what other people think. They're scanning their minds and thinking, how do I put this so that, you know, these people won't think I'm crazy, or these people will think good of me and all that stuff. And so most people, at least openly in the way they interact with others, they're not being themselves. They're being the version of they think other people think they should be. What happened to me with that immense historic level of ridicule in the early 1990s, it set me free. Set me free of that prison. And anyone who's still in the prison, and it is most people if they're honest with themselves, I can't tell you what a freedom it is when you really couldn't give a damn what other people think of you. Doesn't mean you don't listen to people and what have you, but in the end, you decide what you think and say, not anyone else. It's a freedom that's almost beyond description if you've not experienced it. And some of the stuff that I've come out with in my books and stuff since then, which has been from a norm point of view far out, even though I back it up with enormous amounts of evidence, you know, would I have come out with that stuff if I was still in any concern about what people thought of me? I mean, I love it, John, when people have said to me, didn't you know that people would laugh if you said that? And I'm thinking, do you know I'd work that out? Do you know that? So it was a gift. One of the things I said in my books, you know, life so often gives you your greatest gift brilliantly disguised as your worst nightmare. And that was certainly true of me.
It's been an incredible life for you, hasn't it, really? What you've done
Well, it's been many lifetimes, really. It seems to be, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that, a bit of the other. Not so much of the other, John, to be honest. But when you put it all together from the perspective of where I am now, it's been like a seamless journey. You know, my football career ended when I was 20. With rheumatoid arthritis. And that was a great emotional trauma because it had been my dream since I was a kid. What happens then is you feel sorry for yourself, which is the worst thing you can do. Because I remember my father saying to me when I was a kid, he said, you know, it doesn't matter what happens to you, it doesn't matter how bad it gets, until you sit down in a chair and say you're finished, you're never finished. I've always remembered that. I've had good reason to remember it on occasions, but that gave me this, sod it, you know, okay, one door shut, what's the other one? And I'd always been interested in journalism from when I was a real kid. I was always reading newspapers when I was quite young. And that was always my second string. And so I became a journalist. That was an amazing series of coincidences because I left school at 15 and therefore I didn't have any educational qualifications to become a journalist. But, you know, doors just opened. And being in journalism and radio and stuff, that gave me this background of journalism, how to write simply. And then I went into television and that gave me some kind of profile. And of course, I learned a lot about television. And then I went into politics with the Green Party. And that was another amazing story. I start the Green Party on the Isle of Wight. And within weeks, I'm a national spokesman for the Green Party. It was just bizarre. And that allowed me to see politics on the inside and realize that politics is never going to change anything. It's a block on positive change, not a vehicle for it. And by the time I started doing the stuff I'm doing now, plus the fact of the, you know, all the ridicule, which cleared me of the fear of what other people think, put all that lot together, and it was almost the perfect preparation for what I'm doing now in so many ways.
You could never imagine that you'd be going all over Europe talking for hour after hour. It's amazing. When you go to different countries, are you sort of accepted differently? Do you get sort of different receptions in different countries, or...?
Not from the audience. The audiences are all the same. They and by the way, the spectrum of society that is there is incredible. You're talking people from anything from 12, 13, 14 up to 80, 90. Every walk of life, every background, racial group. I mean, you know, it's just this massive cross-section of society. And someone said to me once when they looked out at the audience and saw the amazing diversity of it, they said, well, what on earth connects all these people? I said, one thing, an open mind. That's it. That's all you need. Everything else is irrelevant. But in terms of the media, yes. For instance, when I go to places like Belgrade, talking Belgrade in Serbia, last time I spoke in Belgrade, I was on their main breakfast show live for 25 minutes being questioned on world events and how it all worked. I then went the next day on the second biggest breakfast show. I go on Current Affairs program, the you know, European equivalent of Newsnight. It is completely different. It's in the English-speaking countries where it's pretty much the same. I mean, I had a great set too. You can see it on YouTube. I loved it. I had a great set too with two, I was going to say television presenters, but they wouldn't have been in my day, on Channel 9's main breakfast show in Sydney, Australia. And that was fun. But of course, you know, my experience is that you find far greater maturity in journalism in Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, than ever you do in the West.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
What do you think of current television then?
Well, again, because, you know, I've been around since 1952, I've seen so many changes, as you have. And television's a classic. And I was in television when the big change took place. You know, during... the 50s, there was basically one television channel, the BBC, then ITV came along. And so you were looking at programs, because of the nature of what was the choice, that were absolutely enormous audiences. And then BBC Two came along, and then Channel 4, and then this explosion of channels came along. And what has happened is television channels have been chasing a smaller and smaller slice of the advertising potential. And so that has driven so much television down into the realms of cheap and cheerful, because it's, you know, it's the television equivalent of stack them high and get them out fast in supermarkets. And I think the quality has absolutely gone down. I remember when there were still substantial interviews going on in television, because I think radio is the best form of broadcast communication, not least because there's only a voice and therefore you've got one thing to concentrate on. And also radio does longer interviews. But in television, you know, during the like 60s and 70s when I first went into television, there's still substantial interviews. And then this whole thing came in from America called soundbite television, where everything had to be short and snappy and therefore had no substance. And if you look at a major news story today, the amount of time that's given on television news to cover it is so small that all you can do is just parrot the official version of everything that you've been given. You can't really question it, not even if you had the motivation to, and most of them don't. The whole substance is gone. But one good thing from these multiple channels we have now are things like the History Channel. I think that's brilliant. They came here to this very room, actually, to interview me years and years ago. When everyone here is laughing, oh, David Icke, he's mad. They did this documentary, which has been out so many times over the years now, on the history of secret societies. And they interviewed me perfectly straight. The documentary was delivered perfectly straight. And they do some really good stuff. I mean, if I broke down my recording list of programs on that television there, you'd see loads of them from the History Channel. I think it's excellent. So there have been some good things, but the mainstream has followed the lowest common denominator to a very large extent.
So do you not watch many sort of series or anything like that? What about Bodyguard, the new big hit?
No, I don't watch mainstream television virtually at all. I just watch things to see, you know, what the mainstream is telling us we should believe. I watch RT, the Russian channel. I watch their news bulletin once a day, 5 or 6 in the afternoon, because although, of course, you've got to filter everything, and they're coming from a Russia point of view, they do question things that are happening in the West in a way that the mainstream Western media does not, and so you can get some good information that way. Otherwise, I still watch football as a bit of entertainment. I watch a lot of documentaries on these smaller channels. Some of them are excellent.
I must just say, a great thing happened for football 3 or 4 years ago when Leicester City won the Premiership. You coming from Leicester?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I can't believe it. I first watched Leicester City in the early 1960s when Gordon Banks was playing for them and still hadn't played for England. I remember the first one I saw was Leicester against Nottingham Forest. It would have been about 1962, something like that. And they had a season in 1963, funnily enough, the big freeze, when they finished fourth. And they were top at one point, and they were top because the groundsman had got this idea of putting fires in oil drums all over the pitch. Because you remember the big freeze of 63, there was virtually no football for months. It was unbelievable, but he got Leicester games on doing this thing with the oil drums, and they finished fourth. But I mean, for them to win, and me and my son Jamie were in a bar in Carnarvon in Wales, watching Chelsea play Spurs, because if Spurs didn't win, Leicester won the Premiership. And, we had a few that night, me
I
and
bet
Jay,
you
I'll
did.
Tell you. Because Spurs went 2-0 up, and I was spitting blood. And then Chelsea equalised, and Leicester won. It was an amazing achievement.
David, what do you do right away from chatting, and what sort of is your turn off when you want to get away from what you do?
Well, I don't really turn off, John. I tell you for why. I love what I do. People say, you know, what do you do to relax? Well, I work. I love it because I have this insatiable desire to know what the hell's going on. Because what we're told is going on, even what authorities, most of them know what's going on, is a fraction of what is really going on. So I love it. And one of the things I do on the Isle of Wight is I'll go around and I'll sit in a cafe and have a cup of tea, and then I'll go on to another cafe and have a cup of tea, because when I'm reading books, you know, you sit in a chair, you're reading a book where you've got to concentrate, and the phone will ring, and then you'll start nodding off. Well, you can't nod off in a cafe, can you? So I go out and I read my books. And also, you know, so many beautiful places here. That's a bit of a switch off. But no, I love working because I don't see it as work. I think it's a joy. I'm in a very privileged position to absolutely love what I do. I mean, not many people can say that, unfortunately.
David, thanks for your time. I love chatting to you because you speak honestly. You know, you don't mince your words, which is what life's all about, really, isn't it?
Yeah, open your mouth and say what you think. This is why what is happening now, with a clear, systematic destruction of freedom of speech through internet algorithms and internet giants like Facebook and Google, it's happening with political correctness. You know, we're only going to overcome it if we still keep speaking our truth and don't get intimidated into silence. And, you know, the day I go silent will be the day I leave this world and go to another one, but not until.
Lots of luck with your forthcoming European tour. Lots of luck with the new book. Lots of luck with the movie that's coming along.
Right.
You are busy, aren't you?
I am, yeah, I'm loving it.
And in a couple
just
of minutes.
Just shows you, if you keep going, the waters break and the clouds part. It keep going.
Wishing you continued success, really.
Cheers, John.
And always great to catch up with you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Hi, this is Dennis LeCourriere, the voice of Dr. Hook, and you're listening to John Hannah Meets on Isle of Wight Radio, because you have such good taste.
Well, Dennis took the lead on all those Dr. Hook classics. Sylvia's Mother, If Not You. A very appropriate song for David Icke. A little bit more, particularly when he's doing his 10-hour talks. And, of course, Sexy Eyes. Some ladies think David Icke has sexy eyes. I never looked that close. Grateful thanks to David Icke for today's interview. I love chatting to him because he's never lost for words, which is fantastic. And now some of his tour dates. These are in October, the 3rd in Oslo, the 6th in Stockholm, the 9th in Helsinki, the 12th in Copenhagen, the 19th in Budapest, the 27th, a place in Poland, and it's spelt WROCLAW. I've chickened out there. The 2nd of November, Vienna, the 9th, Amsterdam, the 12th, Glasgow, the 15th, Newcastle, the 19th, Swansea, the 23rd, Watford, the 26th, Torquay, the 30th, Colchester, and finally, December the 8th, in Margate. Wow, he's going to be busy. You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.